This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Wall Street Journal recently published the story of a young man from Michigan who became a source for the FBI and eventually was murdered in another country. The reporter who researched and wrote that story is Brett Forrest, and he joins us now via Skype. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Lester. How are you?
Just fine. Thank you. This young man, Billy Riley, is from Oxford, Michigan. You write that Riley ended up doing part-time work for the FBI. What skills did he have that would make him of value to the FBI?
Well, he had a couple skills that were exceptional interest to the counterterrorism effort at the FBI. He had some language skills. He had taught himself to some degree Arabic and Russian. But in addition, he had a great interest in global conflict. And to that end, he had spent quite a bit of time on the computer and on social media, not only learning about what was going on in other parts of the world, including the Middle East and elsewhere, but contacting people who were involved in certain events. And I think initially it started just as a curiosity to know what else was happening out there beyond Oxford. And this really started for him as a young man, as a teenager. And I think he followed that curiosity into some chat rooms that were restricted, that were run by or people were participating in these chat rooms from movements related to global jihad.
And that's when the FBI started noticing him.
Yeah, exactly. But he came to the notice of the FBI. It's actually quite interesting, through what's called a sensitive site exploitation over in the Middle East. There was a raid on an Al-Qaeda position. This resulted in the recovering of some hard drives. Now, on those hard drives, there were some communications with somebody who was using an IP address at the Riley home in Oxford. And then that information subsequently got passed to the Detroit office of the FBI, and an agent from that office visited the house. And that's how the whole thing started for him.
Now, knowing Arabic is one thing, but there are a lot of sources for the FBI and agents for the FBI who know Arabic. He had a kind of a knack for better understanding what was going on. What was that all about?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, he was one of these guys who could really get his hands around cultures. It wasn't just knowing facts, and it wasn't just knowing a language. It was about really identifying with people in different parts of the world. This is what he would tell his parents, what he would tell other relatives, that his particular advantage, or rather his value to the FBI, was that he could really get on social media and other chat rooms, et cetera, and talk to people in a way that would sort of allow them to accept him more readily.
Outside of his online activities, what kind of a person was Billy Riley? How would you describe him?
Well, you know, Billy was one of these kids. I think we all run across one of these guys, like in high school. This is somebody who is a little bit withdrawn, maybe not so interested in what was going on in the classroom, but sort of brilliant in his own particular way when he did find things that he was interested in. He had friends, but these weren't deep friendships. He really preferred to spend time with his family. He never lived away from home. He was 28 years old when he disappeared, and he was just really sincerely caught up in global events. This is what really moved him.
Who was Billy Riley's contact with the FBI?
He had one guy who ultimately became his handler for most of his relationship with the FBI. A guy named Tim Reinches. Tim was a guy from Kansas City who had joined the FBI some years before and worked out of the Detroit field office. Now, Agent Reinches was Billy's point person at the FBI. But in addition to that, there were other agents who worked on counterterrorism issues that Billy would meet with often. But it was really Tim who was the guy to whom he would file reports and with whom he maintained quite a lengthy text relationship, and a lot of phone calls back and forth. It got to the point where Billy was doing stuff for them on a weekly basis.
And how long was that relationship going on?
That was a 5-year relationship.
Riley, as you mentioned, lived with his parents, told them he was going to Russia. What was the reason he stated for going there?
he was a little vague, or at least he wasn't as forthcoming as his parents might have hoped. His explanation was that since the war had begun in eastern Ukraine, just over the border from Russia in an area called Donbass, he had grown really sympathetic to the regular folks in that area who were affected so negatively by the war that was developing. So he told his parents that he was really interested in helping those people and joining these humanitarian convoys and humanitarian missions that were going from Russia across the border into Ukraine with food and supplies and all that. That's what he told his parents, and his parents it didn't make sense to them, but they couldn't stop him, and off he went.
We should note that he had done some work in that area, Donbass, for the FBI because of a flight that was brought down by either the Russians or the Ukrainians. I think the World Court decided it was the Russians. And then he found out he had a familial relationship with that area. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, right. I think that initial request from Agent Reinches to check out the downing of MH17, the Malaysia Airlines flight, that was sort of the beginning of his, if you will, official role of looking into it. Of course, let's keep in mind, Billy Riley wasn't the only one at the FBI and in U.S. law enforcement and intelligence to be interested in events in Donbass. Obviously, this was a major geopolitical event, but he was one of the many people who was contributing to that effort to try and understand what had happened with the downing of the Malaysian Airlines flight. That was sort of the beginning of his official role related to the conflict in Donbass. But while he was looking at that, one of his grandparents, his grandfather, passed away. And he started doing some genealogy research on his own. And he made a very interesting discovery. He found out that a great-grandfather of his had actually come from the Donbass region itself. So for Billy, that really cemented a personal link to the area and to the people who were there.
So he made contacts with some Russians whom he met and asked for help to connect with a Russian-backed paramilitary group. He told some people it was for a humanitarian effort. Do we actually know what his intent was?
Well, there's a lot about this story that we did find out through our reporting, which took almost 2 years. But there still are questions that we're working to answer, and that's one of them. We don't know 100%. Just why he went over there, whether he went on his own, whether he went at the behest of the FBI or another U.S. government agency, or whether it was something in the middle wherein he would have notified his FBI handler of his trip, which he did. And we don't know whether the FBI said, hey, while you're over there, maybe you want to look into a few things. So we're just not sure. But we do know that before his trip, he was in contact with a man who was recruiting volunteer fighters to go into Donbass to fight on the side of the Ukrainian separatists.
Now, let's make it clear. He has no military background at all, right?
No military background at all, and just judging by his temperament, especially as compared to the type of folks that were drawn to that conflict, I mean, he was really not, this was not his area. These were not his types of people.
His parents were worried throughout the trip, and it sounds like they became somewhat frantic about texting him and encouraging him to come home. They lost contact with their son when he's in that Donbass region. Why couldn't they reach him?
Well, because he stopped responding, quite simply. I mean, he, before he left, his parents had made him promise to contact them every single day of his trip. And he held to that promise for the roughly 6 weeks that he was over there. There's quite a lengthy record of text between him and his family and a lot of phone calls back and forth. But one day he had been getting a little frustrated. He didn't explain exactly why to his parents, but later on we were able to piece together a greater picture of things. And he was getting frustrated that he was sort of stuck in southern Russia, and he wasn't making the move toward Donbass to do the things and see the things that he'd come there to do and see. So he was actually making plans to come home. In his last contact with his parents, he told them, hey, plans have changed. There's a sort of new adventure that's opening up for me, and I'm very excited about it. And that was the last they heard from him.
You're listening to Stateside, and I'm speaking with Brett Forrest with the Wall Street Journal. He recently published the story of a young man from Michigan who became a source for the FBI and then disappeared. So after some time, the parents, his parents start, you know, checking with the FBI and with the Russian government to try to find out what might have happened to their son. What did the FBI tell Billy Riley's parents about his disappearance?
Well, this is when a mysterious story grows even more mysterious, because shortly after his parents hear from Billy the last time, a car pulls up outside their house in Oxford, and it's Billy Riley's handler from the FBI, Agent Reintjes. Now, the parents have never met him. He's never visited the house. And, of course, they find the timing of his visit very curious. However, Agent Reintjes, when he comes into their home, he tells them that he's completely unaware of Billy's trip to Russia, that he's just stopped by to talk to Billy, and he doesn't know anything about his whereabouts. And that begins a multi-year cycle of what seemed to be the FBI playing with the truth with the Rileys. And the Rileys' parents initially believe that the FBI is on the hunt for their son, who had worked with them for 5 years, helping them protect Americans against terror plots. But the Rileys begin to believe that the FBI is actually not looking for him at all, and they're covering up facts and they're thwarting efforts to find their son.
Finally, the Rileys decide to go to Russia themselves, try to trace his steps, find out what became of him. What did they learn?
They learned that he had flown to Moscow and then immediately taken a train south to a town called Rostov-on-Don, which is about 45 miles east of the Ukrainian border, east of the conflict that was happening just over that border. And that he was there spending most of his time there at a volunteer fighter camp, and that's where he was, they believe, the last time they heard from him. When they were in Rostov-on-Don, they met with investigators there and sort of convinced them to open a missing persons case. They also stumbled upon the camp itself, and the people who were there were, the parents found quite threatening, and they were advised not to go any further because it seemed like a bit of a dangerous situation. So they didn't get any answers. They got on the plane. They went back home, and they were very disheartened. They felt like they were never going to figure out what happened to him.
But they did find out. And what was it? What happened?
Well, that's where we came in at the Journal. I, through a source of mine, I used to live in Russia and also in Ukraine, and I spent a lot of years working in these countries. One of my sources, who also has contacts in this area, contacted me and gave me the bare bones of the Riley story. And this person said, well, maybe you can help them. So I contacted the Rileys, and I began my own investigation into it. And step by step, we got a clearer picture of things.
There was a fair amount of pressure on the Rileys to not talk to the Wall Street Journal by the FBI. What was the FBI's concern?
Well, I can only surmise from the evidence that I have and what they told the Rileys. It seems that they were concerned about negative publicity coming back on the FBI. They asked the Rileys if they could try to convince the Journal not to write the story. And if the Journal was going to go ahead with it anyway, they asked the Rileys to convince us not to mention the FBI, which is obviously a central part of Billy's story. So the Rileys, it was just sort of more frustration for them that the FBI, which they'd seen as being not helpful at all in the hunt for their son, was now seeming to, again, look after the reputation of the organization instead.
As we mentioned in the intro, Billy Riley was murdered. What were the circumstances and what happened after that?
Right. Well, I got to a contact of mine who is located in the Rostov region there in southern Russia. And he and I worked together back and forth over a number of months. And we ended up putting together two different sets of fingerprints. One from the U.S. side that I was able to get from the state of Michigan, and another on the Russian side, which was in a database of sort of John Doe's over there. And we were able to make that match last year. And subsequent to that, we did, I got my hands on an autopsy report. And what had happened, of course, still we don't know every detail here, but Billy was, he was murdered. He was stabbed to death. His body was stripped and wrapped in a plastic tarp and thrown in a reservoir outside a small village in eastern Ukraine. A very lonely, grisly death that we're still trying to figure out. But that's what we learned. And we also learned that his remains were buried in quite a larger village not far away from where his body was found.
And his parents recovered Billy Riley's body, brought it back home to Michigan. So what is the lesson we should take from this? What's the moral of the story?
Right. It's such a fascinating tale. It's told on many different levels. There's the personal story of Billy and his family. And within that, you have the story of Billy Riley himself, a kid who grew up in the 9/11 era. And when this whole new world of global conflict opened up, and he became fascinated by it. He became fascinated by the larger world outside of Oxford, and his you can follow his story through the rise of social media, which enabled him to connect with people who are involved in these issues all around the world. Then you have the parents themselves and their personal search for their son, which is, of course, very just a heart-wrenching tale. But the other part of it, too, is probably just as big, is the institutional story, the FBI and the U.S. Fight against terrorism post 9/11. And how the FBI really became, whereas before they were more of a law enforcement body, they became an international intelligence body. And it focuses on a program called the Confidential Human Source Program, which Billy was a part of. And, you know, I think the moral really comes down to the question of what recourse do the people who sign up to be sources have if something goes wrong? The FBI has developed a clear policy of cutting sources loose when things start to have a potential to have some sort of negative blowback on the FBI. And when that happens, you have a situation where Billy Riley, who'd spent 5 years giving all of himself really to the counterterrorism fight, when he needed the FBI the most, the FBI turned its back on him. So you want to ask that question. What recourse do these people and their families have when the FBI behaves that way?
Brett Forrest reported for The Wall Street Journal on the disappearance and death of Billy Riley from Oxford, Michigan. The story is titled, The FBI Lost Our Son. Billy Riley worked in counterterrorism for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, penetrating radical groups online with false identities. Then he disappeared. Brett Forrest, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Lester. Great to be on with you.